This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories this hour. Russia turns off the gas tap to more European countries, cutting flows to Denmark and the Netherlands. China conducts a combat readiness patrol around Taiwan as the island state announces plans for military cooperation with the U.S. National Guard. Also ahead, Oxfam urging the warring sides in Yemen to help avert a massive hunger and more civilian casualties one day before a two-month truce expires. Hello and welcome. It's good to have you with us. Russia widening its gas cuts to Europe. Denmark is the latest to see a halt in gas supply in response to its refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The Danish energy company says it's been informed by Russia's energy giant Gazprom about its decision. That's a day after Gazprom turned off its supplies to the top Dutch trader. Denmark says, however, that it has stored enough gas and could buy more from the European market. Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland, citing their failure to make payments in rubles. Moscow's measure comes in response to a host of sanctions the European Union has imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine. On Monday, the bloc also agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and slash Russia's largest bank from the SWIFT system. The new sanctions sent Brent crude prices soaring to $122 a barrel. Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, is with us from San Francisco. Scott, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us. Scott, gas prices in Europe are already spiraling. Now, was this latest move, in your opinion, by Russia to halt flows to Denmark and the Netherlands expected to push prices even higher than that?
Well, that's going to be a natural occurrence as a result of these sanctions and these policies that the Europeans are imposing on themselves. Russia isn't doing anything. Russia is just simply offering its products, its oil, its gas, and other things in a form of currency that isn't being sanctioned, and that is the ruble. So it's very ironic. Russia has been forced into this position. And in order to survive and receive any kind of payment for its product, it has to receive them in Europe, in rubles, and any other denomination of the sanctions. And what's, I mean, almost comical and tragical at the same time is that Europe doesn't seem to recognize that the sanctions it's imposing is destroying its own economic vitality. It is harming its own people. And of course, this is going to drive the prices higher. What is truly ironic, of course, too, is if Russia wanted to wage a full economic war on these countries that have waged war upon Russia, it could simply stop every single export of gas, of oil, and every other Russian product, and you would quickly see all of the European countries fall into chaos. All of them would seize up, and the machinery of their economy would freeze. They would be unable to cope with the social upheaval and potential revolutionary unrest that would result in Europe. And you could quickly see these regimes of the European countries fall and be replaced by new political leaders that would immediately reopen all economic ties with Russia. So perhaps Russia needs to freeze off entirely these European countries to let them disintegrate under the weight of their own choices and have new political regimes replace them that are far more balanced, intelligent, and fair, and are not these suicidal fascists that seem to currently occupy the positions of the European Union, Britain, and some of these other countries.
But Scott, it seems to me that what Russia and European states are already engaged in is nothing short of a major energy war. Now, with EU states planning to wean themselves off Russian oil by the year end and Russia cutting gas to several countries, now, which side seems to be suffering the most in this battle, in your opinion?
Well, it comes down to substance. Russia has material. It has trees. It has oil. It has gas. It has gold. It has food. It has fertilizer. It has the substance of life. Europe has nothing but credit systems and banking systems. And really, credit doesn't matter when you have a war situation. The only thing that matters is material substance. So Europe is basing all of its policy on the hot air and the fantasy that it is, it is essential. It is some sort of social hub that unites all of civilization, and it is not. Russia is faring far better than any other country. The ruble is at record highs. Half the world agrees with Russia. Only European countries do not. And that's really based on a vanity and a silly, soft, pacifist culture that has grown in Europe like a cancer because of the nanny state that the United States has imposed upon it. But if these countries are trying to wean themselves off of Russian oil and gas, perhaps the best thing for Russia to do is to wean them off quickly by yanking the spigot out of their, out of their economies, and letting them get to that place all the more faster. They really want to wean themselves off. Russia has no problem cutting them off tomorrow from every barrel of oil and every container of gas, and sell it to China, sell it to India, sell it to South America, sell it to South Africa, sell it to other nations, and forget Europe entirely, and let them feel the pain that they have been trying to pose upon Russia. And that pain, I think, because of all of the social instability that is rumbling at the surface of Europe from its millions of migrants that it's brought across over the past 20 years from destroying the Middle East, that's another variable that could cause major societal collapse.
Many, many thanks, Scott. Thank you for coming on. It's always a great pleasure to have you on. That was Scott Bennett, the former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joining us from San Francisco. The U.S. president has confirmed that Washington will send more advanced rocket systems to Ukraine to strike what he said were key targets of Russian forces inside Ukraine. Joe Biden underlined in an op-ed article in the New York Times that the White House was neither encouraging nor enabling Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. He said the U.S. was not seeking a war between NATO and Russia. He also noted that the United States was not trying to bring about the ouster of Russian President Vladimir Putin. He made it clear that Washington will not directly get engaged in the Russia-Ukraine conflict as long as the U.S. or its allies are not attacked. While NATO continues to supply Ukraine with heavy weapons, our correspondent in Donetsk reports that some of those weapons may be being used to target and kill civilians. Here's more.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbas people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted, and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women, and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Chinese military says it has conducted a readiness patrol around Taiwan in response to collusion between the U.S. and the island. The military, in a statement, criticized the U.S. support for Taiwan's independent forces and warned that such measures will put the island into a dangerous situation. The military added that its forces will strengthen their readiness to foil actions by the supporters of Taiwan's independence. The statement comes after Ireland announced plans for cooperation between its military forces and the U.S. National Guard. China, which considers the island as its territory, is furious at the U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. president vowed to defend Taiwan if it is attacked by China. Washington is Taiwan's biggest political supporter and arms supplier. Oxfam has urged all parties to the conflict in Yemen to extend the current armistice to help avert catastrophic hunger and prevent the humanitarian crisis spiraling in the country. The international charity organization says the truce has led to a drop in civilian casualties as airstrikes and ground fighting have significantly reduced. So Oxfam says the opportunity must be seized to extend the truce and push for a lasting peace. The international body sounded the alarm on Tuesday, a day before the UN-brokered ceasefire was expected to run out. A Saudi-led coalition began unleashing a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into a harrowing humanitarian crisis. Iran says the latest reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency on its nuclear activities are unbalanced and unfair. According to Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh, the reports repeat the same errors that existed in the Director General's briefing to the European Parliament. He added that even the agency has admitted to those flaws before. Khatibzadeh urged the IAEA to avoid politicizing its reports under pressure from Israel and other parties. He also talked about efforts to revive the 2015 Iran deal, adding everything now hinges on the U.S. making the right decision.
The United States has unfortunately failed so far to give the required response. If the U.S. stops hesitating in its words and actions and moves toward making a political decision, there will be no impasse in the talks, and the small but outstanding issues in the agreement can be finalized. The current pause in the negotiations is because of U.S. failure to respond to the initiatives put forth by Iran and the European side.
Khatibzadeh added that what Iran needs more than anything now is guarantees that it will economically benefit from any agreement. He said other details, including the U.S. blacklisting of the IRGC, will have to be decided at the negotiating table. We have talked to political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas about the IAEA's recent report on Iran's nuclear program. He believes the agency is neither neutral nor independent.
IAEA is just yet another international institution which pretends to be neutral, pretends to be based on justice, and pretends to be equal and fair in the way it deals with global issues, particularly around the nuclear, of course, the nuclear question. The reality, of course, is something very different. Not one of the international institutions that often act as monitors or act as regulators or watchdogs or overseers of international actions of the various nations is independent. Not one of them. Not the WHO, not the United Nations, not the Atomic Energy Agency, not those who decide what happens with economics in the world, you know, whether it's the World Economic Forum. None of these institutions can ever be expected to act in a fair and balanced way because they were established and remain in the control of, clandestinely, of what I describe as the hyper-capitalist money mafia.
The main ally of the Lebanese resistance movement, Nabih Berri, has been re-elected as a parliament speaker in Lebanon. Following his re-election, Berri stressed what Lebanon needs is a tangible recovery plan. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
On Tuesday, the Lebanese parliament voted to re-elect Nabih Berri as the Speaker of the House. Despite the number of objections which reflect a divided parliament, Berri said in his first speech that his priority is to focus on the needs of the people of Lebanon.
In light of exacerbated challenges and crises which have stormed all Lebanese of all sects or political affiliation, in these harsh circumstances, any plan or promise which does not resolve people's suffering is out of context. The Lebanese and the rest of the world are looking to you as a beacon of hope, possibly the only one to salvage Lebanon.
Our people are suffering, and it's our responsibility to get the laws that will save them economically and socially from the total destruction that has been caused by the regimes and the allies that continually persist in destroying this country.
The whole country is a priority. Where do you start? You start with, passing laws that builds a strong state that stops the bleeding in this country.
Hezbollah members of parliament believe Lebanese people need to see tangible solutions to the current crises.
What is more important than the elections within the parliament is forming a cabinet, since it is the executive authority which governs the country, and it is the cabinet that will be implementing the laws and measures, especially with the recovery plan the Lebanese people are waiting for.
The next challenge for the parliament is the designation of a new prime minister. With today's vote, the general layout of the new parliament will have been finalized. However, with a parliament strictly divided between pro-resistance and anti-resistance groups, it could be difficult to agree on basic socio-economic matters. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Thank you.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Limelight. While the people and the legitimate government of Yemen, led by the popular Ansarullah movement, are eager for extending the two-month ceasefire worked out on the eve of the fasting Ramadan with aggressor Saudi Arabia, despite the latter's frequent violation of the same, the United States of America is busy trying to fish in troubled waters. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kayhan, International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading, Yemen Firmly Against Zionist Infiltration in the Region. Here's the story. While the people and the legitimate government of Yemen, led by popular Ansarullah movement, are eager for extending the two-month ceasefire worked out on the eve of fasting Ramadan with aggressor Saudi Arabia, despite the latter's frequent violation of the same, the United States is busy trying to fish in troubled waters. ever the enemy of the world people, especially of Muslims, and in particular the masses resisting regional tyrants and foreign hegemons, Washington, which supplies Riyadh with deadly weapons, is trying to set up military bases in southern and eastern parts of Yemen. Of course, the awakened people of Yemen will definitely confront the Yankees as well as the betrayers of the Palestinian cause, who treason first destabilized Syria and Iraq and has now heaped death and destruction on the Arab world's most impoverished country. Inspired by the indomitable spirit of such Islamic nationalist leaders as Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the various tribes and political groups of Yemen are determined to thwart the devilish designs of the pro-US Zionist forces. The parliament in Sana'a is now all set to debate and pass a law criminalizing any form of relationship with usurper Israel. Following the recent enactment of the Iraqi parliament to imprison or even sentence to death any traitor advocating ties with the illegal Zionist entity or having any sort of dealings with Tel Aviv. This means, in Yemen, the misconstrued idea of setting up diplomatic ties with the occupiers of Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, whose sanctity is almost daily being desecrated by bands of armed Zionists, never arises. The various tribes and political parties of Yemen understand this and are angry at the UAE occupation forces for facilitating the infiltration of Israelis in several Yemeni islands, especially the ecological wonderland of Socotra, where the Zionists have been allowed to set up a base. In his recent meeting in Sana'a with a delegation of tribal leaders and dignitaries from the southwestern Yemeni province of Aleppo, the Ansarullah leader dwelt on the devilish designs of the U.S. and the Zionist regime through their agents, the Saudis and the Emirates. Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi made it clear, neither can we accept to be ruled by U.S. dictates, nor can recognize traitors and agents who would prefer to be manipulated by Saudi or Emirati officers. He said, the main objective of enemies is to eradicate all elements of national unity, coherence and strength in Yemen in order to exert their dominance over the country, reiterating, the Yemeni nation is firmly determined to tread the path towards independence and freedom and block foreign interference. It is to be noted that the Americans, with the help of the Saudis and their local agents, the Takfiri terrorists, are building several military bases in the country's eastern provinces of Hadhramaut and Al-Mahra, as well as on the Red Sea coast. Riyadh intends to annex these two sparsely populated but mineral-rich strategic regions and would most likely hand them over to the Israelis. This was the reason Saudi Arabia has recently set up a council of six Yemenis who are loyal to the Wahhabis and the Americans and placed them in charge of governing southern Yemen. In the words of Sayyid al-Houthi, they brought a bunch of criminals, traitors and thieves to power and declared them as the leaders of the Yemeni nation in order to set up ties with the Zionist entity. They are actually the picks of outsiders, not of Yemenis. He vowed to continue resistance against the Saudis, the Emirates, and the U.S. by saying, the parties displaying animosity and military aggression against our nation are the ones that are pushing for the normalization of ties with the Israeli enemy, but will never succeed.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Ukraine on fire. Part 2.
Here in Kiev in recent days, the Maidan, Independence Square, has turned into a full-scale war zone.
More clashes in Ukraine's capital, Kiev.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky. The gold, its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the U.S. and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitaly Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR.
Both EU and Ukrainian officials said on Thursday the suspension of talks on closer ties could be revived after the two-day meeting. But officials said the deal was off the table for now.
Pro-EU protests on the streets of Kiev enter their second day. The crowd of around 1,000 protesters were joined by the leader of the opposition, the reigning world boxing champion Vitaly Klitschko. He called on the demonstrators to maintain pressure on the government after it decided not to sign a major trade deal with the EU.
Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies. That helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side presented more favorably. They work on things like, how do you get traction? How do you get things to go viral? How do you then use that to generate support for your cause?
And support was generated.
Mustafa Nayem.
Mustafa Nayem, a founder of one of Ukraine's new media outlets.
Доброго дня, доброї ночі, точніше.
Громадське TV. Knew very well how to make something go viral. It was his notorious Facebook post on November 21st, 2013, that brought the first crowds to Maidan. If you don't read the newspaper, you are uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you are misinformed. To deliver your message efficiently enough in the modern world with so many different technologies and means of communications, you must embrace them all. As the disturbing events of Euromaidan started on November 21st, 2013, three new TV channels went on the air and suddenly became stunningly popular in Ukraine. Spilno TV, November 21st. Romatske TV, November 22nd. And Espresso TV, November 24th, directly from opposition protest. These channels went viral, supporting the protests and encouraging more and more people to come to Maidan. November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events.
After riot police attacked peaceful protesters with clubs.
Happened in the early morning hours. The eyewitnesses that were there said that the police did use truncheons.
Coincidentally, Sergei Lovochkin is a close associate to many U.S. politicians. The security service of Ukraine had evidence that on that night, Lovochkin was in contact with opposition leader Yatsenyuk, where they discussed the clearing of Maidan on the pretext of installing the annual Christmas tree. News media reported that the riot police cruelly attacked the students peacefully sleeping in their tents, but scenes from the event seemed to tell a different story. It appears that the protesters were waiting for the police. Additionally, there were dozens of journalists and cameramen from all the new public TV news outlets prepared to cover the events. And most ominously, a group of well-trained young men arrived to Maidan almost simultaneously with the riot police. They infiltrated the crowd and began provocations with insults, stones, and torches.
The riot sector in Ukraine represents a part of the Ukrainian population that has often favored fairly extreme right-wing positions. They had militias that came especially during the Maidan protests. There were groups that were being shipped into Kiev where they would provide the muscle, in effect, for the demonstrations. So the demonstrations went from being relatively peaceful political protests to being increasingly violent.
The first step in any detective work is to establish a motive. It is now said that Sergei Lovochkin is held in high esteem by his powerful U.S. friends. Outraged by what was reported in the news, the Ukrainian people came out in force on the next day to vent their anger with the police actions. As veiled and masked as the color revolutions can be, an attentive viewer can see subtle patterns and similarities revealing their true nature. To make crowds act as one obedient group, they have to be united at the unconscious level. The masterminds of color revolutions know this well and have perfected the art. Symbolism is one of the most powerful tools to achieve this end. Revolutionary political organizations with surprisingly similar names and even more similar logos have appeared time and again, almost as omens marking the countries that would be hit by the colored plague next. They are often described as being aware and active when they're actually trained and radical. They are the ones who take the first shot, literal and metaphorical, to transform the peaceful protests into full-blown coup d'etats. Their fingerprints can be found everywhere on the map of the color revolutions. Using all the experience of past generations, simple but effective tools like catchy sing-alongs and chanting are employed. Well known for exciting the crowd and creating a group identity, they depersonalize individuals and make them easier to manipulate. Incidentally, one such organization, Romatske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
We will be back here on this square to celebrate with you a Ukraine that stands with Europe and stands with the United States.
Well, members of Congress were visiting Ukraine during that period, most famously Congressman John McCain. So some of the people who were challenging their government, their elected government at that point, were being told by the senior U.S. official, a person who ran for president and a top official in the U.S. Congress, that the U.S. was with them.
I'm Senator John McCain, and it's always a pleasure to be back in Ukraine.
Senator McCain was, in a sense, giving the people in the Maidan a feeling that they had the backing of the most powerful country on earth.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
In early February of 2014, as the Maidan crisis was getting more violent, there was a phone call that was intercepted. It was a call between the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me via VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine.
F*** you.
No, exactly.
I'm not saying the whole U.S. government feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe. The neocons are very smart people, and they've been at this for a long time. They came in around the issue of propaganda. They studied how to create hot buttons for the American people. They had this experience when they were getting the American people to get excited about Central America back in the 1980s.
Sandinista regular army. The ground force is being equipped now with Russian artillery.
And they've been applying those same strategies ever since. They remain very dedicated to achieving their goals. They still want to get rid of certain governments. They wanted regime change in Syria, for instance, regime change in Iran. They're very skilled at this, and they have a lot of allies now inside the news media, inside the government, and that means that they can do a lot to control the narrative of any story.
I think in America these days, we have somehow told ourselves that there are a lot of ways of dealing with these problems other than hard power. Vladimir Putin cares about hard power.
The neoconservatives can now demonize a leader of a country. That sells with the American people. So you don't just sort of argue a policy. You attack the leader. So the neoconservatives became very skilled at picking out leaders, finding their ugly traits, and then highlighting them. Yanukovych, you might say, was a rather clunky political leader, but you make him into a devil. He's totally corrupt, and he's evil, and he wants to kill people in the Maidan, these wonderful white-hatted demonstrators. So you've got a black hat versus white hat. You keep repeating that basic scenario, and it works with the American people.
We've got to realize what Vladimir Putin is. He's an old KGB colonel that wants to restore the Russian Empire.
You make them into demons, and the American people find that the way they can understand the world. Once that happens, it's very difficult for a journalist or anyone else to say, you know, hold it, that guy, he's got more of a gray hat than a white hat or a black hat. And if you say that, you suddenly are you're a Yanukovych apologist or you're a Putin apologist, and then the attacks come on to the person saying it, the journalist, the academic, or whoever.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013 was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city. On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine. This has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs. On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
Father, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus.
Amen.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later.
For weeks, this European capital has been the scene of a violent uprising. Today, the bloodiest day yet.
The protesters are pushing up towards the government district, armed here with Molotov cocktails, but we saw handguns and shotguns too. There are casualties on both sides.
Well, she's just said that there are six dead people up there. Not just injured, dead. They say they've been hit by snipers.
And here again, we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who is at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. Each of you here should stay strong in spirit, he said, because we're not going anywhere.
In the limelight.
Experts and gun control advocates caution that Canada's relatively strict laws do not fully shield it from violence of the kind that is rampant in the United States. A nation where hunting is common, Canada has one of the world's highest per capita gun ownership rates. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Leyland Sesso under the heading, Is the U.S. Gun Problem Becoming Canada's Gun Problem? Please stay tuned for more. On a spring evening in 2020, a gunman disguised as a police officer and armed with semi-automatic weapons began a shooting rampage in rural Nova Scotia that left 23 dead. Nova Scotia is one of the 13 provinces and territories of Canada. Days after the North American country's worst mass shooting, the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised swift action, announcing an immediate ban on about 1,500 makes and models of military-grade and assault-style weapons in the country. He said, these weapons were designed for one purpose and one purpose only, to kill the largest number of people in the shortest amount of time. There is no use and no place for such weapons in Canada, adding, effective immediately, it is no longer permitted to buy, sell, transport, import, or use military-grade assault weapons in this country. Trudeau's actions prompted minimal debate and were met with relatively little political resistance. In contrast to the United States, where the latest mass shootings have once again highlighted the calcified nature of the gun control debate in the country, unwilling to confront weapons violence. But experts and gun control advocates caution that Canada's relatively strict laws do not fully shield it from violence of the kind that is rampant in the United States. A nation where hunting is common, Canada has one of the world's highest per capita gun ownership rates. According to the 2018 Small Arms Survey, there are an estimated 34.7 firearms per 100 people. But Canada is still trails behind its southern neighbor, both in gun ownership rates and firearms-related incidents. Officials claim part of that is credited to a gun ownership regime that mandates extensive background checks and requires that guns be kept locked and unloaded. There are no comparable open carry laws in the country. Gun owners must be licensed, and all handguns and most semi-automatic weapons must be registered with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Ken Price, a gun control advocate whose daughter Samantha was injured in a 2018 mass shooting in Toronto that killed two and left 13 injured, said, "When you consider us next to the United States, which is so heavily armed that it's almost unbelievable, we look purportedly good. But compared to other democratic countries, there is much more we could be doing to address gaps in the system." And the 2020 Nova Scotia shooting joined a list of incidents proving that even Canada's restrictions haven't shielded it entirely from the horrors of gun violence. In 1989, a gunman targeted women at Montreal's École Polytechnique, killing 14 and wounding another 14. A 2017 incident, a young man entered a Quebec City mosque with a semi-automatic rifle and a pistol, killing 6 and injuring 19. Even the man behind the Toronto van attack that left 10 dead was inspired by an American mass shooter. Canadian officials claim, unlike tragedies in the United States of America, these events are largely isolated and have prompted changes to the country's firearms rules. An MP claimed, after the massacre at École Polytechnique, Parliament passed laws that led to the creation of a nationwide gun registry. And Trudeau's ability to ban certain weapons with little political opposition highlights the different way guns are perceived by much of the Canadian public.